Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 13. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your help. Without your contributions, this project would not be possible. Anyway, let's jump into your questions. First, Evan Skiel asked, "Now that we have reached the Battle of Friedland in the narrative, do you feel a sense of melancholy? Because since the beginning of the podcast, it has been mostly an upward trajectory for Napoleon, and now he has reached the absolute zenith of his power and influence. There are still victories upcoming, but nothing like the absolute domination of the late 1790s, early 1800s, and a lot of tragic defeats. I feel like if this were a Martin Scorsese movie, this would be about 1 hour in, when the main character reaches their peak, and the next hour to hour and a half will be them struggling to hold on to what they have, but their pride being their ultimate downfall, a la Henry Hill or Jordan Belfort." First off, I really enjoy the Martin Scorsese metaphor. I think that's a good one. To answer your question, it does feel like we've reached the end of one phase of the narrative. I've mentioned in the past that some of my favorite books about Napoleon's regime are a two-volume set by the French historian Georges Lefebvre, simply called Napoleon. The Treaty of Tilsit is the end of Lefebvre's Volume 1, which I think is one of the main reasons it's been in my head as a midpoint for years. And as you point out, this isn't some arbitrary date. The story will be changing quite a bit very soon. The era of easy victories is over. Spain is looming on the horizon, as is the campaign of 1809, and Napoleon's first ever major defeat. On the personal front, Napoleon will soon have his first child, and his divorce and remarriage are coming up as well. We are definitely shifting into another gear. I don't really feel melancholy about this transition. I've actually been looking forward to taking a break from the battle and campaign style of episodes and delving back into diplomacy, politics, society, personalities, and other more general topics. There was a transition much earlier in the show that made me feel a little sad. Right around episode 50, when Napoleon took power. I had a lot of fun writing about Bonaparte's youth. I felt like I could focus on the small-scale story of one man navigating the French Revolution, and use that narrative to shed light on other subjects I wanted to talk about. But once I got past the Brumaire coup, I found there was barely any separation remaining between Bonaparte's personal story and the much bigger stories of France grappling with the legacy of the Revolution, and the collapse of the geopolitical status quo in Europe. I feel like in some ways, Napoleon the person has become a background character, having been totally upstaged by Napoleon the statesman and Napoleon the conqueror. I also miss being able to shed light on some of the lesser-known aspects of Napoleon's life, and aspects of the history of this period that tend to get left out of popular accounts. Anyone who has read even one book about Napoleon knows about Austerlitz and Jena, the Continental System, and the fateful meeting with Alexander at Tilsit. But even a lot of devoted fans of Napoleonic history don't know very much about Pasquale Paoli, or Napoleon's abortive writing career, or the Bonaparte brothers' failed attempt to become players in Corsican politics. I had a lot of fun exploring these more esoteric topics. I would like to get back to this type of lesser-known topic at some point in the future, but I feel like there's so much ground to cover in the main narrative that I rarely have time. I guess we'll see. Jeff King asked, "Would a cavalry trooper in Napoleonic armies have multiple personal horses, or would they pull new horses from a unit quartermaster? Would the horse be the personal property of the soldier or the national army?" Cavalry troopers often formed close bonds with their mounts, but they did not own them, or even have any kind of rights over them. Their horses were property of the army, just like their equipment. There's an interesting story I read a couple years ago when we were wrapping up our discussions of the camp at Boulogne, and starting to cover the campaign of 1805. I liked this story a lot, but I couldn't find a way to fit it into an episode. As I mentioned back in those episodes, the French army was going through a shortage of cavalry mounts in 1805, to the point where some cavalry units of the Grande Armée marched into Germany on foot, to be mounted later on horses captured from the enemy. At the beginning of the campaign, a veteran cavalry regiment was ordered to give up their horses so they could be used by a freshly recruited unit. As you might imagine, this caused some consternation. For many of these men, asking them to give up their horse was like asking someone to give up a beloved childhood pet, and there was the added sting of the unit being sidelined in favor of totally untested, fresh young recruits. Nonetheless, orders are orders, and the men said goodbye to their horses. A few weeks later, on the march into Germany, these two regiments found themselves at the same encampment. Of course, the men from the veteran regiment used the opportunity to visit their former horses. Apparently, a great many of them were unhappy with what they found. They knew how their former mounts liked to be treated, and they felt the new men were not performing these duties to the proper standard. All evening, the camp was the scene of intense confrontations, as the veteran troopers found their counterparts among the new unit and voiced their displeasure, to put it mildly. Apparently, some of the fresh recruits were even beaten for their lack of care for their animals. So, as you can see, although the horses were property of the army and the men had no rights over them, that didn't stop them from forming deep personal attachments to their horses. Next, Scott Miller asked, who wore it best? Who was your overall favorite military uniform of the era, and who had the coolest hat? For me, the uniforms of the Hussar regiments are the pinnacle of Napoleonic military fashion. This was an era of outlandish and eye-catching uniforms, and no one was more outlandish than the Hussars. As for the best hat, it's hard to beat the iconic tall bearskin hats of the grenadier units, although it's worth mentioning that these were actually only rarely worn. As you can probably tell just from looking at them, they were quite heavy and cumbersome, and could get very hot in warm weather. Day to day, the men of the grenadier units wore the same types of hats as the rest of the army. Those trademark bearskins spent most of their lives tied to a knapsack. The order to put on the bearskins would come just before the unit arrived on the battlefield, or when they were getting ready for some kind of formal or ceremonial duty. There's a good anecdote I cut out of our recent episode on the Battle of Friedland. As the grenadiers of Napoleon's Imperial Guard approached the battlefield, they were marching in their plain bicorn hats, as usual. When the order came to put on the bearskins, one man pitched his bicorn into a nearby river. Some of his comrades followed suit, and apparently within a few moments, the whole unit was doing it. It must have been quite a scene, some little Polish river filled with battered old black hats. Apparently, the men were irritated with so many days of long, fruitless marching, and tossing away their hats gave them a sudden outlet for their frustration. Plain Rap asked, a few years ago, I read a book called Confederates in the Attic, where a journalist spent time with a group of hardcore American Civil War reenactors. And there's a memorable scene in which they slept in period-accurate military field conditions. Four men in the rainy mud, sharing a blanket, spooning for warmth, and turning over every hour or so. It reminded me of how little actual modern civilization was brought on campaign in the 19th century. My question is, how rough was the sleeping situation of the Grande Armée? Did the men have cots in their tents, or was it mostly four guys spooning in the mud? First off, Confederates in the Attic is a good read. If you like this show, there's a strong chance you'd enjoy it. Anyway, on to your question. In past episodes, I've mentioned Captain Elzéar Blaz. He's one of my favorite memoirists of this period, a keen observer and very talented writer with a great sense of humor and a somewhat cynical outlook. One of my favorite chapters of his book is on this exact topic, so I'll read it from here. Before we dive in, just in case anyone is unfamiliar with the term bivouac, it means a temporary improvised encampment. Anyway. Quote, here we are in a beautiful plain, furrowed by artillery and trampled by cavalry. It has rained all day. It is here that we are going to sleep. The order is given. 20 men of each company are sent to the neighboring villages to bring back wood, straw, and supplies. Soon, a curious sight presents itself before our eyes. The market will be good, say the soldiers. The dealers are coming. In fact, from all sides, we see hurrying forward our fearless freebooters, loaded down with sacks of poultry, baskets of eggs, and loaves of bread stuck one after the other on ramrods. Some push before them sheep and cows, oxen and pigs. Others make the peasants, put in requisition, carry the straw and wood. Judging by the scowling faces of the peasants and the interjections which escape them, one can easily see they are not pleased. But their words are drowned by the cries of the animals and by the soldiers' peals of laughter. When one is in the bivouac, near the enemy, every man lies down fully dressed. One sleeps, one might say, with his eyes open. One must be ready for any emergency. Sometimes we remained in our boots for a month, which is, to say the least, very uncomfortable. Sometimes, when lying down, the desire came over one to unbutton one's clothes, one loosened buckle, then another, and it required more time to remedy this little disorder than if one had been entirely undressed. When the season is cold, everyone lies around the fire, but one gets toasted on one side while being frozen on the other. One, of course, has the resource of turning around, but that is not at all easy. When one happens to be in the second line, one can then undress. Fewer precautions are necessary. The officers have linen sacks into which they thrust themselves, and which serve as sheets. Mattresses and feather beds are always replaced by bales of straw. The linen sack is much more agreeable than sheets. The seam prevents anything from getting inside. The time of awakening at the bivouac is never amusing. One has slept because one was tired, but on rising, the limbs of the body are numb. The mustaches, like tufts of alfalfa, have a drop of dew on each hair. The teeth are clenched. One has to rub one's gums to reestablish circulation. End quote. So, as you phrased it in your question, four men in the rainy mud sharing a blanket, spooning for warmth, and turning over every hour or so sounds about right. Although if you were lucky, you would have a linen sleeping bag, so you would at least keep clean. However, in another part of the book, Captain Blaz complicates this picture a bit. Quote, "What renders military life very agreeable is that situations vary continually. When one finds himself in an unpleasant position, one is easily consoled. Soon, that will change. One day, in the mud up to the knees, lacking food and straw on which to sleep. The next day, in an excellent chateau, stocked with pretty ladies, and possessed of a kitchen supplied with all necessary things, and cellars filled to the vaults." End quote. Reading soldiers' memoirs, I am struck by how often they seem to have found ways to have a good time. I'm sure the relatively few moments of fun are overrepresented. If you have 200 nights of discomfort and boredom, and one night of partying, you tend to remember that one night. Still, getting drunk and eating your fill in an excellent chateau with pretty ladies was part of the experience of being on campaign with the Grande Armée, right alongside sleeping with your clothes in the mud on a pile of straw. Next, Stephen Mullaney asked, "What was Napoleon's take on comedy, and was there even such a thing as comedy in that era? Did he have some sort of jester around?" You do not often find the word comedy associated with Napoleon. His public image was of a relentlessly serious man, who only ever thought of his work and the common good. When he appeared in public, he always looked sober and contemplative. His public statements are often witty, but only very rarely outright funny. In a recent episode, I quoted from a member of Napoleon's staff, who talked about, quote, "the seriousness and reserve which was habitual to all those around Napoleon," end quote. He wanted everyone around him working hard, giving their maximum effort, not trying to have fun. That meant setting an example from the top. However, as we've seen many times on this show, Napoleon's public image was not a true representation of his personal character. He was, at his core, a serious person, but he did have a sense of humor, although only those close to him ever saw it. In his private correspondence and in conversation with close confidants, he was often irreverent. He was an outsider by nature, and a keen observer of others, and, like a lot of people with those traits, he had a wry sense of humor. Usually this was good-natured, although he could sometimes go too far and get a bit mean. One of his favorite targets was his brother-in-law and cavalry commander, Marshal Joachim Murat. As we've discussed many times, Murat was an outlandish character in behavior, conversation, and often in his choice of wardrobe. Napoleon loved poking fun at Murat, to the point where I sometimes feel a bit bad for him. We know he absolutely idolized Napoleon and considered him his best friend, so I would imagine being his private jester sometimes really hurt. Bonaparte also loved poking fun at himself. Obviously, he only did this in private. Self-deprecating humor cut completely against his public image, but it was a persistent side of his character. When I started this show, and started reading Napoleon's own words at length, rather than just little snippets quoted in some biography, this constant self-deprecating humor was one of the biggest surprises for me. Now, whenever I read about some dramatic incident from Napoleon's career, I wonder if, on the inside, he was having a little private laugh at some ridiculous detail that didn't make the history books. There's an incident from the memoirs of one of Napoleon's closest companions, Armand de Caulaincourt, who we quoted from in last episode, that I think sheds some light on this side of Napoleon's character. Skipping ahead to 1812, during the retreat from Russia, Napoleon was far ahead of the army. He had to get back to Central Europe to prepare for the aftermath of the disaster he had just overseen in Russia. At one point on the journey, the Emperor and Caulaincourt were traveling in a sleigh, more or less alone, with only a few assistants, quite far from any significant bodies of French troops. They were in East Prussia, actually not too far from the area we've been talking about in the past few episodes. Prussia was technically allied to France at this point, but as we'll discuss in future episodes, the degree to which we can call this friendly territory is very much debatable. Anyway, perhaps understandably under the circumstances, Napoleon and Caulaincourt began discussing whether or not anyone they passed could have recognized them, and what might happen if someone had and decided to kidnap or kill him. It was quite a serious subject, and in very grim surroundings. So Napoleon decided to break the tension. He asked Caulaincourt if he was prepared to be displayed in a cage in a public square in London, and began describing an increasingly elaborate and humiliating captivity, culminating in being covered with honey for bugs to eat. Apparently this got both men cracking up. Caulaincourt described it, quote, "There he was for a quarter of an hour, laughing at this foolish notion. Never had I seen the Emperor laugh so heartily, and his good humor was so infectious that it was some time before we could speak a word without finding some fresh source of amusement." End quote. So there you have it. Napoleon was a serious man, but when things got dark, and he was in the company of someone he trusted, he preferred to laugh. I'd like to close out this installment with a long quotation. This is from the memoirs of Denis Davidov, the flamboyant Russian cavalry officer and poet who we discussed in Dispatch 10. This passage describes the arrival of several units of Bashkir cavalry the day after the Battle of Friedland, when Bennigsen's army was on its retreat towards Tilsit. These were irregular troops, raised from steppe tribesmen native to south-central Russia. Quote, "On that day, as if to offer us distraction from dire events, several Bashkir regiments arrived to join our vanguard. Armed with bows and arrows, wearing caps with long ear flaps, and dressed in weird-looking caftans, riding on short, bulky mounts that lacked any elegance, they seemed to represent caricatures of bold Circassian horsemen. We were supposed to believe that their appearance was intended to impress Napoleon with the notion that all the peoples and nations under Russia's rule were ready to rise up against him and give him real cause for concern." What might have given him concern was not the spectacle of a handful of barbarous tribesmen, but the prospect of 300,000 reserve soldiers of the regular army, standing battle-ready at the frontiers of the empire, under the command of a determined general well-skilled in the art of war. But as it was, Napoleon was hardly likely to be deluded by such fantasies. Had the situation been reversed, and our victorious army invaded a European country, it is possible that a multitude of natives from the Urals, Kamiks, and Bashkirs, sent as a diversion into the enemy's rear, might have induced a state of panic. Their numbers, their appearance, their wild behavior might have perhaps stirred the imagination and conjured up the hordes of Attila the Hun, as effective in its way as the capture of military supplies and provisions. But after the defeat at Friedland and our retreat to the Niemen, when our own infantry, artillery, and cavalry could barely contain the attacks of victorious Napoleonic forces approaching the frontiers of Russia that lay open and unprepared for an invasion, how could anyone hope for success by opposing 15th-century weapons to 19th-century cannonballs, shells, grapeshot, and bullets, even if the warriors with their bows and arrows had presented themselves in unthinkable numbers? Be that as it may, Frenchmen and Russians who came across these Bashkir horsemen were unanimous in greeting them with laughter. That evening, stories circulated of the adventures with the Bashkirs during the course of the day. I myself was witness to one rather amusing episode. During a skirmish, we took prisoner a French lieutenant colonel, whose name I have now forgotten. To this officer's ill fortune, nature had bestowed on him a nose of extraordinary size. While the vicissitudes of war wished to have his nose shot through with an arrow, which was embedded to half its length. We helped the lieutenant colonel down from his horse and sat him on the ground, so that we could free him of this distressing adornment. A crowd of onlookers, including a few Bashkirs, gathered around the victim. Our physician grabbed a saw and prepared to cut the arrow in two, so as to remove it painlessly from either side of the enormous bulge. When one of the Bashkirs recognized the arrow as one of his own, and seized the physician with both hands. "No," said he, "I would not let you cut my arrow. Do not offend me. Please do not. It is my arrow. I will take it out myself." "Are you mad?" we said to the Bashkir. "How will you get it out?" "Well, I will take one end and pull it out, and the arrow will stay in one piece." "And the nose?" we inquired. "And the nose," he answered, "the devil take it." You can imagine the roar of laughter that greeted his words. Meanwhile, the French officer, not understanding a word of Russian, was trying to guess what was going on. He begged us to chase the Bashkir away, which we did. The affair was settled, and in the end, the French nose triumphed over the Bashkir arrow. End quote. That's all for now. Thank you again for your support, and I'll be back to you in a few weeks with more of the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.